This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
The following talk on PIGOO was given by David Collard, Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Bath, for the mini-conference on PIGOO at Robinson College, Cambridge, on the 29th of November 2013.
Well, this paper is a very general one. It's a general appreciation of PIGOO. Background is that I did get interested in PIGOO from very early on. The first thing I did was to write a chapter in a book published by Dennis O'Brien and John Presley called Pioneers of Modern Economics.
So that was your first?
Yeah, that was the first thing I wrote about PIGOO. And I mentioned in there that he was around when I was an undergraduate at Cambridge. But he used to sit in a kind of deck chair on the lawn of Kings and was kind of unapproachable and had a reputation of being eccentric and not wanting any discussion in economics. I remember sitting next to a rather old lady on a nice sunny afternoon in Kings on the backs, people punting up and down, who recollected that she went to some lectures, though she wasn't allowed to be an official student. She went to some of his lectures when he was young and thought he was terribly dynamic and attractive and all that. So that was my only sort of link with PIGOO, really. But as I got older, I've become more and more impressed with the way in which PIGOO had a sustained interest in doing serious economics and was willing to adapt and go along with change, contrary to what Keynesians might believe. I started my paper in a slightly fanciful way, imagining that I might have more people here. I was pretending to be the compere at a presentation of the sort of TV awards or whatever, so there'd be a red carpet and people sitting at tables wondering if their name would be called and preparing a smile or tears or whatever. So I start here by pretending to be a compere. I have great pleasure in announcing the 20th Century Awards in Economics for Outstanding Technical Achievement, Paul A. Samuelson, for Outstanding Originality, John Maynard Keynes, for Outstanding Exposition, John R. Hicks, and for Outstanding Lifetime Achievement, Arthur Cecil PIGOO. I call upon Professor Collard to present the award. It really needs, like Henry V, it needs a kingdom for a stage, princes to act kind of thing. What I've done here is I've divided this thing up mainly into discussions of PIGOO's main books. But I start by talking about Wealth and Welfare, on which I've written, and copying you, really, I think, I've written an appreciation of that for the Cambridge Journal of Economics, which is coming out early, I think, in the new year, hopefully early. And that was presented to a conference at Kiel in 2012, so it was on time, but it won't be published until 2014. As you all know, the Economics of Welfare started out as Wealth and Welfare, published in 1912 by PIGOO. I start with welfare economics because welfare economics was PIGOO's baby. He more or less gave birth to it, nourished it, and fussed over it. His book started out as Wealth and Welfare and grew into the four editions of The Economics of Welfare. The book was well received, and even in Young's well-known critical review of 1913, Young said, "The book represents the science of economics at its best so far. No work known to him is its equal in the combination of scholarship, analytical penetration, and lucidity of exposition." That's Young's comment on the 1912 book. So I'd like to just say a few things about PIGOO's welfare economics to start with. And the way I do this in the paper, because I've written elsewhere quite a lot about the economics of welfare, is to just take a few bullet points to present. The first thing, bullet point, is the tripartite structure, where PIGOO emphasised the social dividend, national income, and its size, its distribution, and its variability. And he stuck to that. the variability thing got pulled out and put into the industrial fluctuations book later on. But I think the structure is interesting because he takes the Marshallian concept of the natural dividend and wants to put it to use. It's about policy, effectively, which is bullet point two. It's supposed to be a program for what he called improving people's lives. The third thing is that they were just criteria. One sometimes thinks of trade-offs between, say, equity, size and distribution and all that. There weren't trade-offs in Pigou's analysis. Though he had these criteria of size and distribution and variability, they were criteria rather than trade-offs. So you couldn't say, okay, we'll accept a bit less income for a bit more equality. It wasn't into that. It was rather that other things be equal, if you get a bigger income, or other things be equal, if you get more distribution, the same with variability, then that would be an improvement. So so it was kind of conservative, I suppose, in that way. The book is most known, I suppose, for externalities, Pigouvian taxes and subsidies, later to be challenged by the Chicago school and Coase and all that. But I think this is enduring as a legacy if one looks at current climate change discussions or whatever. Pigou's externalities actually are right up there as concepts that are still relevant. There is a theme I picked up in another publication, and that is about generations. I think one can just about make the case that there is a Cambridge tradition of looking at intergenerational activities. And I've based this on Mill, who wasn't, of course, Cambridge really, Sidgwick, Pigou and Marshall. Particularly Pigou's notion of a defective telescopic faculty and his prompting Ramsay to write his paper of 1928 on optimal saving. Next bullet point is that there's a lot of labour economics in this book. And in fact, it's true in all Pigou's writings that he comes back to labour economics over and over again. The setting of wage rates, you know, part-time versus full-time, unions, bargaining, all those issues. So much so, I quote Schumpeter here as remarking that it was the greatest venture into labour economics ever undertaken by a man who was primarily a theorist. So that was, mustn't forget, Pigou as a labour market economist. That's taken up by Solow, I think, even more recently. And also, lastly, Pigou's slow retreat over output taxes and subsidies illustrated that he could be rather stubborn, which is sometimes a useful characteristic. Mm-hmm. But it's well known that he really blundered a bit over subsidies to taxes on decreasing returns industries. Mm. But he was very reluctant to let go of that. Mm. And there's a bit of an element of subsidies to increasing returns industries that I think is kind of relevant to growth discussions still. You know, people always try to spot winning industries and throw public money at them. Well, that's essentially what he was arguing there in that section. Not necessarily correct, of course. Has the economics of welfare stood the test of time? Not very well, it seemed, half a century later, because Pigou's utilitarian, this had given way to Parisian welfare economics, where you just have to check the first order conditions, and as Robbins and the LSE crowd said, distribution is a separate issue, it's a value judgment, so you can't really incorporate the two in a utilitarian fashion. And of course there was a long period where Pigou's type of welfare economics crumbled rather in face of various critiques. If you take distribution out of it as something economists can comment upon, and if you say, well, if you argue like Coase that the market can take care of externalities by legal processes, and if you take Buchanan and Culloch Virginia view about the self-interest in the public sector, so you can't really replace private failures by public virtue, And Stigler's saying about contestable markets, all those things actually rather blunt Pigou's implied critique of the market. There's less and less reason for intervening once you accept these things. I do argue, though, that the climate has, in a sense, changed here, particularly if you talk about climate change and talk about collapse of capitalism 2008, all those things tend to argue in favour of a bit more public intervention rather than less. So I ask in a paragraph here, why not an award for Pigou's welfare economics? Why not indeed? But there was a great deal more to come, nearly a lifetime, in fact. So I'm talking about Pigou's other contributions as well. I do say he wasn't without his faults. He was prone to make technical slips. He was said to keep himself aloof from his younger colleagues in Cambridge. He gave the impression of being on the wrong side of history, as it were, in the evolution of both micro and macroeconomics, and his writing style could not be said to be highly readable. Having noted these faults, real and apparent, I shall move on. I am, after all, presenting an award, and award givers always accentuate the positive. Having established that Pigou was a major welfare economist and deserving of an award for that reason alone, let's look at some of Pigou's other lifetime achievements. So I first look at a couple of minor, relatively minor matters, and that is demand and money. Pigou did not write major works on demand or money, but I think his 1910 and his 1930 contribution to demand analysis were interesting, and I do seize upon Angus Deaton, who was a colleague of mine at Bristol, actually, and Angus remarks in his book on demand that this was still one of the best examples of indirect measurement by use of theory outside of the physical and biological sciences. And that is the piece where Pigou assumed independent elasticities and was able to calculate price and income elasticities and the sort of relationship between them. And that was kind of entirely original. And quite early in his career, 1910, 2 years after he'd been appointed to the chair. And this would I think, deserve a footnote in history, at least as a technical achievement. And then the second point is his quantity theory of money. Pigou wrote what became the kind of definitive statement of the Cambridge equation of demand for of Cambridge version of the quantity theory of money. And I could say some more about that in discussion. I don't want to say too much about it now, but suffice it to say there was an oral tradition, as you all know, that the demand for cash balances version of Fisher's quantity theory of money was well known in Cambridge, and that Pigou simply made it explicit. When trying to establish precedent, an oral tradition is always tiresome to outsiders, and I suspect insiders sometimes claim too much for it. Pigou claimed very little. He claimed to be controversial, and he simply made the point that his version and Fisher's versions were equivalent, but that his version was probably better because it emphasised the demand for cash balances rather than just a purely mechanical relationship. But it did incorporate what Patinkin later called the invalid dichotomy, in that Pigou assumed that the values of all the other commodities apart from money weren't affected by the value of money. So he had a demand for cash balances equation, which was a rectangular hyperbola, and I think it actually was it's meant to be an equilibrium device, but lent itself to criticism. Actually, talking now about Patinkin sort of dates one rather. There was a time when it was terribly modern to talk about Patinkin. Yes. Now seems rather a long time ago, I must admit. So Pigou was in that tradition, but he was obviously aware of connections between the real and monetary sectors. On the one hand, he made this assumption about the separateness, but on the other hand, when he invented the concept of income velocity in the Industrial Fluctuations book, he actually had the income velocity depending upon interest rates and various other things. So once you allow that, of course, you've opened up the link between the monetary and real parts of the economy. Let's start now then with the next big book after the welfare books was the business cycle book, 1927, Industrial Fluctuations. I used to take the view that this was not a very satisfactory book, but I think my view of it has improved a lot over the years. Schumpeter? Yes, it was Schumpeter who said that Pigou's book came nearest to a definitive treatment in the interwar period. It wasn't an original work, except in its architecture, which I thought was, I think again and again with Pigou, I come back to the structure of the book that he's talking about. And the architecture here was to say, okay, it's all driven by business expectations, the whole thing, very expectations of businessmen, of the immediate cause, and they're driven by impulses that could come from real factors, or psychological factors, or monetary factors. There are various things that could set off, impulses could set off a business cycle. And then, once they've started, it's a question of how big or how small the fluctuations are going to be. But I've noticed that recently people have started to use the term Pigou cycles. Mm-hmm. And I think it relating really to the psychological impulses to set off a cycle. But it was very Catholic in its approach. You know, it was expectations, but they could be set off by any one of a number of things. Mm. And once the impulse started off, how were they going to be transmitted from one sector to another? And I do mention briefly a theme which I've covered in an article in the EJ a few years back about Pigou and modern business cycle theory, because Pigou's real factors are, of course, the factors that are emphasised in real business cycle theory. But he didn't accept that the cycle set off would be an equilibrium process. And he criticised what he called the old doctrine of economic harmonies, suggesting that it would not, if I could find a quote that would do... Well, all I say here is his refusal to accept the old-fashioned doctrine of economic harmonies, thus rejecting in advance, as it were, equilibrium business cycle theory. Other things in the book are the first statement of the Phillips curve, which I think is interesting. It's there, it's absolutely plain and diagrammatically and discussed in this book. And lastly, a discussion of policy. This led me later on in the paper to suggest that if Keynes wanted a balanced assessment of Pigou on employment, he should really have looked at industrial fluctuations rather than the theory of unemployment. But that's obviously debatable. Policy, well, in terms of policy, he didn't suggest anything very radical. He suggested that in terms of monetary policy, you set a target probably of stable prices. This could be achieved by discount policy, which would be anticipatory, and you could use early indicators of this, such as stock market data, as indicating when the anticipatory discount rate might be changed. Government expenditures could move money spending from good times to bad. That would be okay. Unemployment insurance, yes. Wages, well, here we go. Talking about wages, he insisted that wages should be plastic so as to minimise the unemployment effects of these depressions, but not too plastic if it was very damaging socially. This is very, very Pigou. Right, next book, Public Finance, 1928. This is another of Pigou's major tomes. I do start by saying that given Pigouvian taxes in the earlier book, you might have thought that part of this book would be elaborating on Pigouvian taxes and subsidies. But Pigou says, no, I've talked about these already. So he didn't mention them. The structure of this book, again, is very interesting. I always think with Pigou, it's the structure. He starts by looking, he looks at government expenditure. What's the principle? The principle is equimarginal values. You distribute government expenditure to get equimarginal returns. But they have to get a bit more than the marginal cost because of the what he called the announcement effects of taxation and the admin costs of taxation. So you have, the returns have to be throughout all measurable. They have to be measured, they have to be a bit above marginal cost to allow for these, factors. Okay, that's government expenditure, which I think sets out the basis for cost-benefit analysis. The second part of the book is about taxation. How do you, what principles do you use to decide on the structure of taxation? Well, there you've got Pigou the utilitarian at work. You set taxation, the structure, so as to minimise disutility. Tax being a disutility. At least aggregate sacrifice. This is, I think, the most utilitarian of Pigou's passages. And this is very interesting too, because it led him to argue for a progressive tax system. It also led him to consider tax systems that favoured capital accumulation, because of his defective telescopic faculty view. And of course, led to Ramsay's paper of 1927. It was Pigou, of course, who gave Ramsay the problem to work out. Pigou said to Ramsay, what would the tax structure have to look like in order to minimise the utility loss from raising a given revenue? And that led to Ramsay's paper, which is sort of passed into history. And I think that is the Atkinson-Murley stuff about optimal taxation springs directly from that, and Atkinson acknowledges that totally. So it was, I think, in terms of structure, it was interesting. It's kind of coherent. Another comment from Young, who reviewed it, the same Young who reviewed the earlier book, said, Professor Pigou is consistently an explorer. His interest is always in the margins or frontiers, where by dint of painstaking analysis, new knowledge is to be had. Well, I'm quite jealous of this book, because it was a very successful textbook. It went through three editions and was reprinted five times, apart from having an interesting intellectual structure. So there you are, Pigou wasn't just drawing upon old theory, he was actually absorbing new technically difficult methods, which he himself had done much to stimulate. Oh dear, we now come to the theory of unemployment. I haven't put the date of it here, actually. Is it 33? 33, yes. it's in the references. This, of course, is famous for being the butt of Keynes's critique in the general theory. And it is a difficult book to talk about, really. It really takes the demand. The first part takes the demand curve for labour as a given, and talks about plasticity of the wage, so that the more, in response to any movement, the more plastic real wages were, the less the unemployment effects would change. But the demand for labour curve seems to be given in part one, which makes it rather sort of very, very un-Keynesian in approach. In part two, he's concerned with remedies if the demand curve shifts for labour. And here, again, is arguing that real wages, that the more plastic real wages were, the better it would be in terms of employment. Now, I'll read the next section. Given Pigou's record, particularly industrial fluctuations and the theory of unemployment, is a profoundly frustrating book. Became, of course, the butt of the appendix to chapter 19 of the General Theory. In Keynes's view, Pigou's book was a book about employment, which, though written in a depression, assumed full employment of labour. The structure of the book is not quite neoclassical, which Keynes called classical, in that it is built around the demand curve for labour, with the supply side, never entirely clear, being described in terms of the number of would-be workers and the plasticity of real wages. Having dealt with definitions in part one, part two is entirely taken up with guesstimates of the elasticity of the real demand for labour. The book has drawn praise from Solow, 1980, who saw Pigou's concerns with the effects of monopoly, regional variations, etc., as rather modern, but complained his guesstimates were rather high. Parts 3 and 4 are about the causes of shifts in the labour demand function, both real and monetary. So this is, I think, where it's not quite right to say he was concerned entirely with full employment, because you've got these shocks in the labour demand function, and the employment effects depend on plasticity. I paraphrase this part 5 discussion as: labour demand falls. This has no effect on employment in long run equilibrium, but it does, of course, reduce the real wage of the still fully employed workforce. In the short run, the extent of unemployment depends upon wage policy, by which Pigou means the policy of organised labour. The less plastic labour is about its stipulated real wage, the more unemployment. Plasticity is not the same as elasticity. It's about the rate of change of wages in response to a change in the labour demand schedule. Pigou seems to leave a policymaker with very few attractive options. Allow some reallocation of labour over time and persuade workers to be more plastic, which is exactly the set of recommendations he had in Industrial Fluctuations earlier. Am I okay for time?
Yes, I mean, the more you present, the less time there is for conversation.
Yeah, okay, right. I'll sort of curtail some of it here. Mm. Now, there is a... Yeah, I have to make a slight digression for the next book to be discussed. This is The Economics of Stationary States, 1935. This is a kind of unimportant book. It's very meticulously exploring the marginal analysis in a steady state context. He appreciates that steady states can be steadily expanding states or contracting states, but they are steady states. And he was drawn to this several times. When you get to the 1940s, he's still interested in stationary states, which, of course, who was it refers to, the frozen...
Keynes was...
In your paper, you referred to the frozen... Yeah. And Pigou was attracted to this, which he knew was a long-run unrealistic assumption, but he was obviously attracted to the analysis of it. The Economics of Stationary States, I would see rather as, when I was a student, James Mead, although developing growth, neoclassical growth theory, wrote a textbook called The Economics of Stationary States, which hasn't been a bestseller, and I don't think that made it. But he, the professor at Cambridge, wondering what would happen if you ground out all the conditions for a stationary state. Now, it's precisely what Pigou was doing here. And although it didn't form part of any contribution to policy, I don't see why a Cambridge professor shouldn't sit down and write a book about stationary states if he wants to. It's all worked out rather meticulously. Mm. I say here, it's surely the least of Pigou's tones. It's very worthy, but does not earn him a place in the pantheon, and is seen to be overshadowed by Pigou's response to Keynes. Right, now, we can come back to Pigou and the general theory, I think. I don't want to say much about that, because we can come back to it in discussion. What I said in the first thing I wrote on Pigou, I thought that the young Keynesians were, to say the least, rather ungracious about Pigou's contribution. Mm. And it's a bit like a campaign on Facebook or something to denigrate the poor chap to one another. But there was clearly a difference of view, that Pigou was coming to it in terms of plasticity of wage, of real wages, and Keynes was coming to it in terms of effective demand. So there were clearly two different approaches here, although I see that they're going to be amalgamated sometime this afternoon. But they do start from different places. So perhaps I ought to leave that little section there. But in terms of the 1937 paper, which Pigou wrote on real and money wage rates in relation to unemployment, Pigou uses his device of the equilibrium firm, where price equals expected marginal prime cost, which includes an interest element. If the real wage were to fall, the firm would be in disequilibrium, output would have to expand. But the postulated fall is in the money wage, so we have to make some assumption about banking policy. What are we to assume about the interest rate, the price level, and the quantity of money? Pigou tries to fix things so that none of these changes. This is tricky in respect to the interest rate, which may indeed be reduced temporarily. He insists, however, that this is an entirely separate matter and denies that a cut in money wages must operate through the rate of interest. It's enough for my purpose to show that a money wage cut is not simply a piece of ritual that enables the real cause of unemployment expansion, a fall in the money rate of interest, to take effect. Now, this is the point at which he gave in to criticism of Kaldor and said, yes, okay, the effect could well be mainly through the change in the rate of interest. Mm. The interim reaction of Keynes and the younger Keynesians, which I first described in a chapter in the Pioneer's book, reminds me of those hate or bullying campaigns that are reported on social networking sites like Twitter. It's not a good atmosphere in which to carry through an academic debate. Ill and discredited, this would have been a good time for Pigou to have drawn a distinguished career to a close. But there was more to come. And my last section is called A Late Flowering, and this is Employment in Equilibrium, 1941. In reviewing this, Kaldor referred to the admiration which the reviewer feels towards the volume as a whole. Its well-planned logical construction, the subtlety of its analysis, are bound to place Employment and Equilibrium among the best things the author has written. The fact that it is the sixth major treatise on economic theory that the author has produced bears witness to a record of achievement which must surely be unique among economists. Now, that's pushing it a bit, but I think, you know, if praise from Kaldor doesn't impress, then there's Samuelson's judgment that it was one of the most important books of recent years, and in terms of methodology, almost ideal. Now, the reason that it's almost ideal in Samuelson's view goes back to structure. As I keep repeating, Pigou was a great man for structure, and the structure of this Employment and Equilibrium book was that you describe the economy. By this time, Pigou, I think, has been converted to the idea of exploring the economy in terms of a small macro model. In 1937, he wasn't there, but I think by 41, he was actually setting out a small micro model of his own and saying, okay, we can have various multipliers because they're the total derivatives of things that we can change in the system. And two of the most important derivatives, there are half a dozen at least. In the first part, there are half a dozen, then he has more. The two of greatest interest are Keynes's multiplier, which is Pigou's multiplier M of 3, and the money wage multiplier. So those are the two big things that have been controversial in the late 1930s, and Pigou tries to incorporate them as special aspects of a model which tries to integrate everything. Not entirely successfully, he does make some mistakes, but he does calculate qualitative multipliers for three alternative models, the second of which is trivially different, but the third embodies imperfect competition as well. So he's trying to assess what these multipliers would look like under perfect competition and imperfect competition. Now, for an old guy, this isn't bad, in my view. In fact, I once stupidly wrote, when I was a lot younger, I once wrote that for a man of 64 or something, this was a remarkable achievement. I look back on 64 as being terribly young. So it was rather patronising to make this. Well, he comments at one point about, I've used this comment before, contrasting his approach and Dennis Robertson's approach. And he says, Dennis has been spending years meticulously examining and criticising Mr. Keynes on this and that, instead of getting on, as I think would be much better, with constructive work of his own. Pigou to Keynes, 1938. Well, this Employment and Equilibrium book was constructive, was it not? No. And he used something similar in the Classical Stationary State article, which I won't bother to mention. It's here in the list. I'll come to the end now then. I'll quit my last paragraph. This brings me near the end of my catalogue of Pigou's achievements over his professional life. I've left his various minor books to one side. They include The Riddle of the Tariff, 1903, Principles and Methods of Industrial Peace, 1905, Economics in Practice, 1936, Socialism is Capitalism, 1937, Income, 1945, Lapses from Full Employment, 19, 1945, The Veil of Money, 1947, Aspects of British Economic History, which was written a long time before, 1948, and Income Revisited, 1953. I have not emphasised Pigou's academic relationships with his younger colleagues, Ramsay, Strafford, Kahn, John Robinson and David Champernowne, which, in spite of his reputation for aloofness, were often positive. Nor have I considered his personality or personal life. It is true that Pigou led the quiet life of a bachelor academic, but he did have an interesting hinterland, his climbing in Switzerland and the Lake District. I've often wondered whether I could get access to the attic of the cottage at Buttermere, where he stayed when climbing. His principal pacifism, his practical jokes, his personal friendships. I particularly like his attempt to interest Macmillan in one of children's stories he'd written for his friends. After a discouraging reply, he accepted, "There it must lie until discovered 100 years hence as a forgotten masterpiece. As far as I know, it has not yet come to light." Therefore, ladies and gentlemen, in your thousands, I present Arthur Cecil Pigou as eminently worthy of the award for outstanding lifetime achievement.